time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for December 8th, 2018. Once again, our cycling world was rocked to its core when the news of the untimely death of Paul Sherwin was announced earlier this week. For over 30 years, Paul and Phil Liggett have been the voices of the Tour de France, and at only 62, it seems patently unfair that we will no longer be able to rely on his wry and insightful commentary anymore. Our deep condolences go out to his family. R.I.P., Mr. Sherwin, you were one of a kind. For those who would like to hear his voice again, my conversation with Paul Sherwin from May 31st of 2014 can be found at OutspokenCyclist.com. My second item of interest is to say thank you. Your voice made a difference. I heard back from Karen Whitaker, Vice President of Government Relations for the League of American Bicyclists, and the language in the AV START Act bill has been changed. Karen said, quote, "The authors of the AV START Act agreed to a change in language so that manufacturers have to certify that their automated vehicles can detect, identify, and respond to bicyclists, pedestrians, etc. The old language just required them to certify that their AVs had a sense of bicyclists and pedestrians. There were also improvements to the liability language, the data sharing language, etc., that put more onus on the manufacturers. We believe it gives us a hook when working with manufacturers and with the government." She says it's still not a great bill, and she thinks we'll be better off if it fails and we start over, but it is an important win for improved safety. She said, quote, "It is fair to say that our voices made a difference and we were heard on Capitol Hill and the bill is better, but we still have work to do." So thank you again. It's awesome that you picked up the phone, sent emails, and contacted your senators and made a difference. Woohoo! So let's move on to this week's show. We feature three new conversations, beginning with our local Bike Cleveland director, Jacob Van Sickle. When I think back to what I would call the very beginning of bicycle advocacy, the original League of American Wheelmen and the Thunderhead Alliance are what come to mind. It seems like that was such a long time ago. Yet today, there are advocacy organizations in every nook and cranny of the U.S., and they're doing some amazing work on the ground to make roads safer and routes more reliable for cyclists and pedestrians alike. Recently, Bike Cleveland held a one-day summit to bring us up to speed on what's happened and what is in the works for the Northeast Ohio area. It's amazing what's already been accomplished and what the next steps are going to be. We'll talk with Jacob in a moment. At the end of the show last week, I briefly mentioned a story that would both break your heart and make you smile. Stephen Swift has been dealt one hell of a hand, from losing his wife in a car crash to three separate bouts with cancer. But the human spirit rises to the occasion when necessary, and Stephen's story offers up hope as his 26,000-mile bicycle journey is about to come full circle. Lastly, we'll speak with a young entrepreneur frame builder turned toolmaker who is making some big noises in that space. Joe Rogenbuck is only 28 years old, yet he seems to have the wisdom and understanding of someone with way more years. He's already got a big following for his work, and he's got big plans for the future. So let's get to it as we talk with Bike Cleveland's director, Jacob Van Sickle. Hello, Jacob. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me. Happy holidays.
Yeah, happy holidays. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I mistakenly missed an email from you and was unable to attend your recent Bike Cleveland Summit. And so now we want to know what happened. I did read some of the materials you sent me, and you've got some lofty goals. Tell us about the summit and what you wanted to accomplish at, at this time?
You know, here at Bike Cleveland, we started back in 2011 hosting a large community summit, and that really helped kind of lay the groundwork for what Bike Cleveland would work on, you know, developing our mission and our goals. And, you know, it'd been 7 years, and we thought, you know, we've really accomplished a lot, and it'd be great to kind of update our mission and our goals and really engage the community in that process. So November 11th, we hosted a summit where we brought 84 or so people together to really, you know, look at our mission and our vision and our values and our goals, and really to provide feedback and, you know, what are people experiencing, and what do they think we should be working on as a bike advocacy organization to really improve safety for people biking and walking across the region.
And I think you probably accomplished some good stuff. So I wanted to tell you about a short conversation I had. Actually, it was a long interview with Tim Blumenthal from People for Bikes, and he mentioned a new tool on their site that allows you to compare cities and how they're faring in five areas. And Cleveland came up at 3.9, which is remarkable because the highest is a 5. And according to Tim, there isn't a community worldwide that gets a 5. So how has Cleveland and Bike Cleveland brought us to this point of reaching out and getting more people on bikes?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just being that persistent voice and kind of being a glue that brings people together. You know, over the past 6 years, we've advocated for over 80 miles of new bike lanes and trails. And we host programs every year that draw anywhere from, you know, 5,000 to 9,000 people. We've been kind of the thought leaders on protected bike lanes with our plan called the Midway, which is a plan for a network of protected bike lanes that utilizes some of our overly wide streets in the city of Cleveland. We do education programs that are pretty far reaching across demographics with police officers and getting civic leaders out on bikes and kids and refugees and seniors. And really all of this is kind of helped boost us. And the People for Bikes tool, I believe it's called Places for Bikes, really ranked us high on acceleration. And I think a lot of those programs that we're doing, you know, getting infrastructure on the ground and helping people use bikes has, you know, helped us rank really high on there.
So one of the things you just said was about narrowing streets. And I talked to people, other people who think that, oh, no, you know, we need wider streets. Where do you see streets that can give up? And I can see plenty of them. But where is Bike Cleveland looking at streets to give up some of the lanes to make it safer for cyclists? And explain your thinking about making narrow streets and what it will add to the community as opposed to take away.
Yeah, so I think any street in the city of Cleveland, pretty much, you know, any main thoroughfare, think of like Superior and St. Clair and Chester and Carnegie and Lorain and Detroit. You know, these are streets that were, you know, built years and years and decades ago that were built for when we, you know, had a population approaching 1 million people, and now we're at 400,000. So we're really at this time in our existence where we can really rethink the way the street works, you know, as we continue to see more people out biking and walking. And, you know, how can we really reorient those streets to be, you know, safer for not just people driving, but people that are choosing other modes of transportation? You know, for us, it's not just about biking even. It's about, you know, making the streets safer for everybody, which then, you know, results in a higher quality of life because, you know, people are able to bike and able to walk. And there's a good number of studies actually that say, I think one of them was done by Jennifer Dill, 56% of people want to bike more, but they're concerned about safety. There's a study by the Urban Land Institute that said 52% of Americans want to work in a place where they can, or want to live in a place where they can walk to work. And, you know, really the work we're doing, kind of reimagining streets and advocating and mobilizing people, are really supporting those and building safe places for people to bike and walk.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jacob Van Sickle. He is the executive director of Bike Cleveland, right here where we originate this podcast. I think that I'm seeing some really remarkable things. You know, I think back 30 some odd years when I was in the bike business going, well, when are we going to be able to see this? And when? So it's been a long time that some of this has started to come along. What are some of the major obstacles to, you think, improving our cycling and walking infrastructure besides narrowing streets?
You know, I think the biggest obstacle is just, you know, kind of this fear of change, you know, from the general public. You know, people people utilize a street for years and years, and that's how it works. And then, you know, we come in and we say, you know, the street's being repaved. Let's rethink the way it could function and try to accommodate pedestrians and cyclists in a better fashion. And we get a lot of pushback. But what we hear most is, you know, people are worried about safety on their street. And what we do is, you know, we communicate them, you know, this isn't really about adding a bike lane or a buffer bike lane or a protected bike lane. This is really about improving safety on the street. I think that really resonates with people. One of the other big obstacles I think we run into is making your streets safer, you know, accommodating them better for bikes and pedestrians, buy-in from civic leaders. You know, I think that's why we work to try to get council members out on bikes and host events where we invite civic leaders to come out so they can see, you know, people biking in your community is a good thing. It's good for community health. It's good for social connections. It's good for a multitude of reasons, and try to shift the mindset to think of, you know, the way our streets are designed should be a priority, because the way it's designed has a number of benefits.
And one of the things in your summit was talking about diversity and inclusiveness, and Cleveland is a very diverse community as a whole. You know, you have a lot of immigrants, you have a lot of pockets of people. You know, people tend to really sort of, I hate to use the word ghettoized, but they almost do. They almost, you'll find, you know, Italians are in Little Italy, and you'll have Slavic Village, and you'll have the Huff area, and all these areas where people tend to not come together. And I'm wondering how you will be able to make it more inclusive, or if cycling is a way to make it more inclusive.
I think it's the former. I think cycling is a way to make it more inclusive. But I think what we're learning is we can't always just approach it with a cycling mindset. You know, it involves, you know, going into the community and listening to people and understanding what their concerns are, and then finding a way we, as a bike advocacy organization, can meet some of their needs with some of the programs that we have. You know, in Cleveland, there's some neighborhoods where 50% of the people don't have access to a car. You know, so they rely on alternative forms of transportation, and biking could be one of those forms. And for us, it's really about, you know, being in the community and listening, and figuring out, you know, how what we offer can help, you know, resolve some of people's needs, and how we can engage them and engage them in our work and our advocacy campaign. So, you know, it's not just, you know, us coming in and saying, you want a bike lane on this street, but it's actually coming from the community.
Yeah, that's an important perspective. It's one I actually hadn't thought about, that starting with them as opposed to coming in and saying, we're going to do this. And it makes a lot of sense. How important is a protected bike lane network?
I'd say, you know, if you look at a lot of cities that are starting to implement protected bike lanes, or have been implementing them for the past, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years, it's crucial. I think, you know, I mentioned the Jennifer Dill study that said 56% of people want a bike, but they're concerned about their safety. And protected bike lanes are really a way to address that. In an urban environment, especially like Cleveland, you're not always going to find space to be able to build an off-road trail, but you will find space within the road right-of-way to be able to build a protected bike lane to encourage more people and entice more people to come out and ride bikes for, you know, transportation, recreation, just getting around. I think the other key piece to that question is not just protected bike lane, but a network. You know, a protected bike lane is one piece of bike infrastructure that's important, but there's a lot of other types of infrastructure that are helpful, like neighborhood greenways or bike boulevards, things like buffered bike lanes. And I think each of those have their place within the ecosystem of roads, and really building out a network, utilizing those tools to build as stress-free of a bike network as you can is crucial.
Yeah, so you already got to my next question, which was about connecting some of these areas that you may be able to get onto a path or a lane, and then it doesn't take you to the next place you want to go. So were there conclusions and decisions that you came to at this summit, and what's the next step?
Yeah, real quick on the connections one.
Sure.
We actually worked with Rails to Trails Conservancy this year, along with the City of Cleveland and our local MPO, the Northeast Ohio Airway Coordinating Agency, to develop a tool called Bikeable that really analyzes our existing network of bike facilities and our future planned network of bike facilities, and analyzes how connected they are from origins and destinations. So this is a tool that we're going to be working with various partners on to really plan out and prioritize future investments in bike facilities. So, you know, what the tool can tell us is, you know, if we build this 3-mile section of protected bike lane, we'll increase the connectivity of residents to jobs by X percent. And it can help kind of prioritize the different plans that we have to building out the bike network.
Wow. Sounds like a really valuable tool. That's interesting. I'll be anxious to see how it works. So let's wrap it up with the conclusions and decisions at the summit and see what happened and what's next. What is the next goal, short term and long term?
Yeah. So at the summit was kind of the culmination of our feedback gathering for our strategic plan update. So we did a series of focus groups, interviews, surveys, and then the large community event, our summit. And we're taking all of the information gathered from all of those different engagement opportunities as a board and staff to coalesce them into what our strategic priorities are going to be and what's our action plan for the next 5 years as an organization. So we're coalescing it all right now. And our goal is to announce it and share it with our members and the public at our annual meeting in January.
Well, I guess we'll have to catch up again and find out what you found out at this summit in earlier this month. Well, Jacob, thank you so much for bringing me up to date with what's going on only in my own hometown. I have seen, going through the Places for Bikes tool and comparing Cleveland to a lot of other areas that I would have thought were doing well, Cleveland's doing really well. And I know Bike Cleveland has been a big, big part of that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great holiday and we'll talk again.
You too. Thanks,
all right. Okay. Bye-bye. Jacob Van Sickle joined me from the offices of Bike Cleveland in Slavic Village. If you're interested in getting involved with the organization, as well as learning about what has transpired at the Bike Summit, you can log on to bikecleveland.org. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back to speak with Stephen Swift about his long journey. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Stephen Swift has a story that will at once make you smile and cry. He's experienced incredible loss and has gained some amazing love and support as he's traveled over 26,000 miles in the past 6 years. I caught up with him in Arizona as he was about to begin the final leg of his journey back home to Oregon. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thank you.
Well, you have one of the most inspiring stories I've heard in a long time. I think my listeners are going to love it, and I think it's a great story for the holidays.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, when people hear your story, they'll understand how important that particular comment really is. So let's start at the beginning, about 6 years ago. Tell us what transpired that brought you on the journey that you're just about to wrap up after 6 years?
Well, what happened was I had a wife and two daughters, and my wife was in a car accident with my youngest daughter, Savannah, and she was in a car accident, and she passed away, and my daughter, Savannah, was in a coma for 3 months, and Savannah fought for her life. Well, that was part of it. And then 10 months after my wife dies, I ended up getting diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer, given 18 months to live. And it actually was my daughter, Savannah, who basically saved my life, because it was her determination to live and fight that I learned how to live and fight for my life, too.
And clearly, that 18 months has turned into something completely different. Completely different. So Savannah gave you this sort of will to live and move on from there. So pancreatic cancer is usually truly not survivable.
Right. It's a fatal disease.
So how did they cure it?
First.
Okay, wait, you're going to say it's not your first cancer?
Right. I had bone cancer prior to that, and I was basically in remission from that for like 10 years. And then to get diagnosed with another cancer, a little more worse than the first.
Wow.
It was tough.
So how, if pancreatic cancer, which I know that the survival rate is very, very low, what kind of treatment were you given, and what do you think helped you beside the treatment? I'm hearing something else going on.
Well, I was, after all this stuff, I was in a very humongous depression state, and I had to talk to my family and friends, you know, and it was Savannah who came up with the idea of the bike ride. And I rode with, you know, stage 2 pancreatic cancer for about a year. And, you know, I was getting sicker and sicker. And I ended up getting surgery in Arizona and just surgery. And, you know, I think with the biking exercise, you know, change of attitude, change of diet, it saved my life.
What did you do to change your diet? What kinds of things did you leave out, and what kinds of things did you put in?
Well, I used to drink a lot of soda and a lot of milk products and a lot of, you know, like, you know, processed foods. You're working, you know, and you're eating on snacks all the time, and, you know, they're not good for you anyways. And, you know, on the bike ride, I wanted to feel healthy, so I changed my diet around, and I drank a lot of water, a lot of, you know, citrus fruit, a lot of veggies and things like that, bananas for potassium and so on. And I just, you know, started feeling a lot better, but still, you know, I still have my cancer. And so I got so sick one day, and I almost died that night, and that's when they did the surgery. And it was surgery. It wasn't chemo or radiation.
So did they remove a portion of your liver, or pancreas, rather?
Yes. The top portion, also my gallbladder and appendix, because it was metastasized and down to other organs.
Wow. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Stephen Swift. He has an amazing story, and we're going to talk about the good things here in a moment, I hope. Okay, so you kept on riding. Tell us where you started this journey.
I started home in Newport, Oregon, after dropping my daughter Savannah up in Portland. That's where my sister lives. I have another daughter, Lacey, and I have a vehicle that I dropped there first. And Savannah and I were on a bus, and I got her little computer so it can help her with her memory, because she has a memory loss due to the accident. And I just hopped on the bike, you know, on Newport, Oregon, and headed south. It was only supposed to be in state, and I ended up going to California and then into Mexico and then beyond.
So I have a question about how you're supporting your daughters and yourself and these illnesses. I mean, it's just amazing to me. Plus, of course, you've lost your wife. How are you supporting yourself on the road?
Well, I find sponsors and I work as I go, but, you know, my two daughters, they, you know, from family, they have, you know, their own monies, and, you know, we have a business, and all. My daughter now, you know, she was going to school, basically, you know, supporting her own self and so on. And it makes me so proud. She's a lawyer now.
Wow. This is your older daughter?
Yes, my daughter, Lacey. My youngest daughter, Savannah, you know, she was so excited this spring when she got her first job. She can't work a normal job. She's like special ed because of her injuries. But I was excited for her.
What's she doing?
Well, she's just basically working in kind of like a Goodwill, you know, and, you know, sorting things out and stuff. And yeah, I'm proud of her.
Yeah, no kidding. She sounds like a young lady to be proud of. So let's talk a little bit about your journey. You are right now in Arizona?
Yes, I am. I spent Thanksgiving with a family that I met out in Yuma, Arizona a few years back. And they invited me for Thanksgiving because I honestly, truly haven't had Thanksgiving with my family or anybody in the past 6 years since Renee died. And it's been 7 years since she passed.
Wow. So now it seems like people on the road are becoming your family.
This is true, yes. I have millions and millions of family members.
That's pretty cool, actually. What kind of bike are you riding, Stephen?
I am on a Giant right now, but I had two trucks and they were stolen. And prior to that, I had a Raleigh, so I had a variety of bicycles.
Man, that's so bad when people steal your bikes. Are you self-supported, so you bring your own sleeping bag and tent and sleep out, or you just use warm showers? What kind of accommodations are you using?
Well, I do use warm showers, and I think that's an awesome thing to have, you know, especially when you're out in a city or something like that, you know, and there is no campground. But basically, I stay in hotels, motels, and also campgrounds. California has the most strangest and the most expensive campgrounds. I mean, Oregon is a lot cheaper and stuff. Arizona don't even have, like, hike or biker, you know, and that makes me upset a little bit because, you know, they don't even know what that means.
Hmm.
I think every state should have hike or biker.
Explain what hike or biker is for my listeners who don't know, including me. This is the first I've actually heard of hike or biker. Tell me what that is.
Okay, hike or biker is a camp area where it's set in a campground for people who are traveling on through. They can stay up to 2 to 3 days, you know, and they're paying like $5 to $12, $20. And it's a lot cheaper than actually a motel or a hotel. But you can't take a car and just park it and then, you know, expect to, you know, be called a hiker or anything like that. The rangers are really, you know.
Oh, I get it. I get it. Oh, that's really interesting.
About that, yeah.
So they actually dedicate a portion of the campground to people who are hiking or biking through.
Right, they dedicate area.
Yeah, that's
and
really
most
cool.
Of these places are very beautiful, especially up in Oregon. I don't know if you heard, but REI donated a lot of money to make the Oregon hiker bikers more compatible and stuff. They put in new lockers. They put in charger places, you know, tools and stuff, you know, a stand for the bike and so on, new campgrounds, new tables, everything.
That's pretty cool. We just got our first REI here in Northeast Ohio about maybe 6 months ago. It just opened. So it's nice to know that they're here and that they do those kinds of things.
Oh, yes.
Tell me what you talk with people about as you travel through the country.
Every day I'm going to businesses and things like that to try to see if people would, you know, sponsor or hang up a flyer and stuff, because I take a newspaper article, which I love so much. Basically, if people really want to know my story, they could go online, and there's tons of stories on there. If they put Stephen Swift biking for cancer, it'll come to this huge page, and like there's 4 or 5, maybe even 6 pages full of articles, videos, pictures, and stuff about my ride throughout the year.
Wow.
Even with a PH, not a V.
Yeah, right. We will make sure that before we end this conversation, we get people on the right page.
Right, and I think they'd be very inspired. But, you know, you asked what I talk about. I talk about, you know, my whole entire, you know, experience with cycling and also, you know, cancer and just it's awareness. It's going through pain, going through, you know, the trauma, going through the surgery and so on. And, you know, I meet other people who are actually going through cancer, and I try to encourage them, telling them never give up, never give in, always go forward, fight.
Do you believe that cycling and your diet change and the surgery that you have put you in a place where you're going to continue to be able to ride your bike, and are you well?
No. But yes and no, okay? I do have a third bout of cancer I'm dealing with, and this one is the tough one. It's leukemia now. It's a blood cancer. The other one was a bone and basically, you know, a stomach cancer. This one here is serious, and I've had it for about 5 months now, and I'm heading back home, and I'm going to write my book and, you know, get that out there for people to actually read and be inspired by. And it's been hard. It's been a tough road, you know. It's been sometimes really extremely hard, you know. I mean, if you were to, you know, ask me about how the road trip was, I would tell you the truth, you know, that people treat you like crap all the time, you know, and you're on a bicycle trying to feel comfortable in the clothes you wear and not wear cycling clothes. And, you know, they make you feel like you're homeless on a bike and stuff. And it's not right. They don't even know my name. Why should they even judge me? That happened just a couple of days ago, you know, when I did an interview with a local TV stations here, you know. The reporter was still in the building, and, you know, somebody called security on me, and it just was very uncomfortable.
Wow.
But the people who run the place that I'm staying at, you know, they apologized. So, you know, it's just one person out of a whole apartment complex. But, you know, you get that every single day with somebody judging you, and it's just not right.
It seems to be the way society is right now, unfortunately. And it's very rarely that I speak with someone who has honestly said to me they aren't treated well on the road. And I'm always surprised when people say, oh, I never have any problems. No, everybody's always really nice. We know that isn't true because we know cyclists are harassed on the road a lot of the time. And I really appreciate your honesty. Let me remind our listeners once again that I'm speaking with Stephen Swift. He is on a very interesting journey, and it's a journey for his life, pretty much. So go ahead. What were you going to say, Stephen? I'm sorry.
You know, there are some awesome, cool people out there. You know, like, people do stop me. Like, I was stopped by the sheriff's department up in San Bernardino County, so Santa Barbara. You know, it's kind of cool because they stop me, you know, and they actually stop me on hotel, you know, who does that?
Right.
This is the sheriff's department I'm talking about, you know. And then, you know, coming towards Phoenix, you know, I was stopped by the fire department who were fighting that fire up in, you know, kind of Central California, the Woy fire.
Right.
I'm sure you heard of that.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, they stopped and all four of them got out and started talking to me. I have these guest books that people write in, you know, a guest book where they write, you know, a little innuendo message for their name, or, you know, can put a card or something in it. And I have 56 of those, believe it or not.
Wow. I don't even know how to ask this question. You have like this legacy of information and support, and even, you know, not always support. Other than your website, do you like give people talks along the way? I mean, are you invited into, say, schools or other, like, libraries to talk to people?
Yes. I stop at a lot of cancer places, you know, like hospitals and agencies and things. And, you know, I do also talk in churches, you know, kind of almost like a testimony. And then, you know, there's other certain hospitals and places that you do, you know, give a speech to and so on. Because, you know, people want to be inspired. They don't want to be, you know, put down, let down, or anything like that. They want to be encouraged. And so, you know, if you can just encourage one, you made it. It makes your day.
How are you coping right now with all the stuff that's going on? Are you getting all the support and all of the medical attention that you need?
Yes, I do have insurance. I do have a business back home in Oregon. And I'm excited to go back home. I haven't been home, physically home, in over 6 years, okay?
Holy smokes.
So, well, I still have a home. The only way I don't have a home is if there was a fire or earthquake or a tsunami. And none of those happened yet, so I still know I have a home.
What's next? You're going to go home, and then what?
And that's huge. I mean, that's a big, huge question. What am I going to do next? Well, I plan to get my daughter and maybe take a trip to Maui with my two daughters. My daughter, Lacey, she's out in Washington, D.C. right now, out your way, and she'll be coming back home in August of next year. And I was thinking, you know, maybe having holidays again, since I'll have both daughters home. Start living my life the best I can, deal with this illness that I have now. And just read a book, and I heard they want to make a movie, too. So that's pretty cool.
That is very cool. I would like to see that movie. Well, you'll let us know, yes?
Yes, positively. one thing I did want to say, okay? This is very important, okay? On the road, you know, you meet good people, you meet bad people. You find people who inspire you, you inspire them. You know, people think they're meeting somebody really famous, and I don't ever feel famous. I just feel like Stephen Swift, a cyclist, you know? And there was a time where, you know, you were put in the right place at the right time, or maybe it was the wrong time, but let me just say this real quick. I was coming from San Francisco down the coast, okay, heading south, and I stopped in Half Moon Bay, okay, this past, January. Anyways, I just left the campground, and I had a slow leak in my back tire, and I had a bob trailer with me. And I stopped and to check my back tire. Well, as I looked around, I seen a vehicle down a ditch 50 feet down, and it didn't look right. How did that vehicle get there? So I went down, and this was one of the hardest things on this whole entire ride. It didn't put a damper on my ride. It just, I don't know. I was just guess I was supposed to be there. But anyways, I went down there, and there was a body of a 20-year-old boy in that vehicle. He's been there for 2 days, and, you know, I called the police and so on. And 5 minutes after I called the police, his family shows up. They put a missing persons out on him, and nobody knew where he was or anything, and I just happened to do that. So cyclists are very important, you know, just cycling every day. They would never have known if I didn't go by there.
What a amazing story. I hope they put that part in the movie because it's a big part of the story. Wow.
It is. But, you know, they could go online and just actually read that themselves. You know, they didn't put my name in it, which I thank God for. But, you know, they did put bicyclist. But if they put down, like, Half Moon Bay, 20-year-old dies in Half Moon Bay accident, they'll find it.
And Half Moon Bay is one of my favorite places. It's beautiful. That's really, really a sad story. And yet you got some closure for that family. Well, Stephen, this has just been such an interesting and amazing conversation. I certainly wish you well, and I hope you
are
able to get well. Tell our listeners how they can follow your story.
Well, they can either email me at believinginjuries60@gmail.com. You have that, right?
I do. I will put it on our Facebook page if that's okay with you.
That's fine.
Okay.
And also by just, you know, Googling Stephen Swift, Biking for Cancer, every story is there. You know, they can email me, and they can go on Facebook, too. My Facebook is Swifty Stephen. I can spell that out for them if they like. It's Swifty, and then Stephen, Stephen, and that's my Facebook.
That's how I found you. That is how I contacted you, with through the Facebook page, actually. Well, I wish you so much luck, and I hope you will be well, and I hope you get to take that trip to Maui with your girls. Thank you so much for talking with me. It's been a wonderful conversation. I think it's a great holiday story with lots of hope. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. You've been amazing, too, you know. I really appreciate, you know, you even contacting me and letting me be a part of your broadcast.
Well, it is my pleasure. Absolutely. So be safe, be well, get yourself home, get yourself well, and we'll keep following your story, Swifty Stephen.
That would be so cool. I'd love that.
All right. Thank you.
And thank you so very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you're interested in some of the stories about Stephen, just type his name into any browser. See what comes up. We wish him well as he completes his long journey back home. After a break, we'll be back to speak with Joe Rogenbuck from Cobra Frames in Syracuse, New York. He's one interesting hombre. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Get back to the show. I think that social media is especially helpful for promoting new folks with innovative ideas. If you go to Cobra Frames on Instagram, you will be dazzled by some of the photos of Joe Rogenbuck and the work he is doing. Here's my conversation with him. Hi, Joe. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining my show this week.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I think we have a lot to talk about. And let's start with the basics. Who is Joe Rogenbuck?
Well, my name's Joe. I mean, I'm a 28-year-old. I live in Syracuse, New York, and lately I've been making the tooling for bicycle frame builders, small-scale bicycle frame builders who need specific tools to get the job done. That's something that I used to do, was to make bicycle frames, but I liked making tools so much that I decided I should actually move in the direction of specializing on that and offering the tools that I make for sale to other folks.
Cool. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Michigan. My dad was a farmer and my mom was a nurse. And so I grew up driving, you know, big tractors and diesel trucks and stuff. And I did that for a while. And then I went to college and I didn't feel like living in that part of the world anymore. And so that's not anything I do anymore, but that's where I grew up.
So how did you become interested in building bike frames? I know you worked with Doug Faddick, so did my husband. And I guess you met Herbie Helm, who was there at the same time Brian was.
Yeah. So, I wasn't particularly interested in bikes more than any other kid until I was like 19 and I was in college and I got really into them very quickly. I did a 900-mile bike tour from Michigan to Washington, D.C. It was sort of an environmentalist thing that we did, and I just loved it, and I got into riding fixed-gear bikes. You know, this was like 2009. Yeah, I don't know. I just really fell hard and fast for bikes at that time in my life, and it was in the first year that I was seriously into bikes that I had seen some custom bicycles, and they were, I want to say, the first person who ever really stuck out to me in that was Ian Sutton made Icarus frames, and they're just beautiful. The paint job, I think, usually was done by Circle A Cycles in Providence, and the it was like bi-laminate fillet construction, and it was just gorgeous stuff, and it really caught my attention, and I wanted to learn how to do that. It just seemed so cool. And living in Michigan, I heard about Doug Faddick's class, and so I took it. And I had only really been riding bikes for a little bit over a year at that point, so I didn't have nearly as much perspective about cycling in general as most people do when they would, you know, get into something that serious.
Yeah, but it seems like your path has been at, you know, like a million miles an hour. If you're only 28 and you've already done a whole lot of stuff. So I have a question about how you ended up in Syracuse.
Yeah, well, it's not that interesting, but, I finished college and I was 22 and I was dating someone who I knew from college who was in grad school here. And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to stay where I was going to school. I'll just move there. And that didn't last any too long, but I've been here the last 6 years or so, and it's been a great place for a lot of reasons, mainly just that it's affordable enough that while working crappy part-time jobs at bike shops and stuff, I've been able to afford to have a little space to practice making bikes and things.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point that, you know, when you go to one of the big cities like Boston or even Minneapolis,
yeah,
or, you know, you really can't afford to have what you want in terms of space and like the outdoors even. So, you know, mm-hmm. I've been looking through your gallery of frames, and it's really clear that you actually embrace a lot of modern technology. So you worked with Doug, and he specializes sort of in these brazed lugged frames. And yet now here you are doing disc brakes, 44-millimeter head tubes. Actually, you're not, I know you're not really building frames right now, but you instantly sort of gravitated towards all the modern stuff. What was it you see, or what is it that you see in the modern stuff that keeps you working, even your tooling, toward that?
Certainly. I mean, for me, I think part of the reason that I made a shift was because I was so new to cycling when I found out about frame building and I took a class so quickly. And so I didn't know exactly where I fit into it, but that was the stuff that immediately spoke to me. And I didn't honestly know that much about what was out there at the time. You know, I didn't know that much about the contemporary frame building with, you know, TIG welding. And I just didn't know that much about all the different kinds of builders there were and stuff. And so, you know, I think I gravitated in that direction sort of just as I did it over and over again. The lug work and the hand filing felt kind of tedious, and I loved it, and I'm still a fan of that. But I think when you talk to average folks who just ride bikes and love bikes, they'll say, oh, that's cool. You know, they kind of like look at a, you know, a beautifully carved lug or something, and they're like, oh, that's neat. You know, and it just, it doesn't mean that much to them. And I think not that to say that it doesn't mean that much to anybody, but there's a lot of people that just kind of goes over their head. You know, it takes sort of an appreciation, like a you need to understand what went into it to really see the beauty in it, I think, a lot of times. And I feel like if you're trying to like build a business or something and you're trying to make a machine that people love and care about, it just kind of felt a little bit more like direct and straightforward to me to focus on the things that your customer and the average person would notice, which, you know, is like a paint job and which is the frame geometry and the fit and the, you know, the ride feel and those sorts of things. And I think part of the reason that I really liked the brazing and stuff is it felt like there was so much artistry to it. You know, it felt like it was such a beautiful thing. And it was only after I learned how to TIG weld that I realized how much beauty and artistry goes into a nice TIG weld. And it's subtle. Nobody who doesn't weld would really notice the difference between a great and an okay weld. But when you know what to look for, there's plenty of artistry there. And so I think it was something where I had to, you know, I had to play with frame building for a while to figure out what it was that I was after. But, you know, I like the modern stuff, I think, just because it seems to, you know, perform well. And, you know, that's what companies are making bike parts for.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Joe Rogenbuck. He is in Syracuse, New York. His company is CobraFrames.net. You know, that's a very, what's the word I'm looking for? It's a very experienced comment. Your commentary is very experienced for somebody who has, you know, I mean, I know you have a lot of experience, but you look at some of these builders who have been building for 30 or 40 years, and they don't have that perspective. I have to give you a lot of credit. I think it's pretty interesting and pretty awesome.
Well, thanks.
No, well, you're welcome. So let's talk a little bit about your CNC stuff. So when you, I mean, a lot of your stuff is on Instagram. I know that. And you do have stuff on your website, you know, your pretty prayer hands. I like that because I'm a yoga teacher. So I noticed that right away. But what's your favorite piece of equipment in your shop?
I think it has to be, if I just answer straightforwardly, it has to be my CNC milling machine. That's something I picked up only in April of this year. And prior to that, I didn't have a lot of experience using those kinds of machines. And I certainly didn't own one. I didn't have access to play on one. And I had older machine tools, a Bridgeport milling machine and a Clausing lathe and those sorts of things, grinders and bandsaws. But so I could make things slowly, but the way that this sort of machine allows you to, you know, you can sketch something on a computer and you can produce the part, you know, within a couple hours, you can make a pretty complicated and beautiful part exactly to size, exactly the way you want it. And it's pretty straightforward. And I just love that. I don't know. It's amazing to have that sort of capability to own that. As an individual is just kind of exceptional to me. And so, I mean, I would have to say that's my favorite machine, but there's some other pieces in my shop too that I just love. I have this one cabinet that I got when I bought some other machines, and it's just a steel cabinet that's probably 50 years old, and it has different drawers that are the perfect size for bicycle frame tubes. And I can just put like top tubes and down tubes and seat tubes and chainstays in these different drawers, and they slide out beautifully, and then I can pick the drawers out of the cabinet and carry them around the shop. And so I always say that's my favorite piece in the shop, even though it's so simple. But, like, those sorts of things are, you know, it's hard to find that kind of thing if you're looking for it. And when you do find it, it's amazing.
No, I get it. I absolutely get it. You know, when we get a new piece of equipment, it's because it fits into what's missing. You know, it's that it's that slot that you don't have something to put.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about your Cobra tools. So you began by doing some framework, and then suddenly you needed something and you made it, which is the way I know it always works. And then suddenly other people are finding out about these tools, like these clamps. They're very clever. Tell us about how you decided to focus on tools as opposed to on your frames.
Well, I mean, it's a confluence of things. One is that, you know, I was kind of, you know, I started young and I didn't have a good job or anything. I didn't have any good way to afford to buy the tools that were already out there. And I'm a cheapskate. So I'm like building my own tools to avoid paying a very reasonable price to other people for their tools. And so that's kind of how it started. And I just really, I found myself like, I would build tools for a while, and then I'd say, okay, I got to build another frame. I can't just keep building tools. What am I, you know, my frame builder or not? So I'd start building a frame, and then I'd say, God, I don't have this tool. I don't have that tool, and I need a way to do this. And it just felt like I kind of liked making frames almost more than I liked making bikes. And, like, not to say that I didn't like making bikes, but I just really liked the problem solving of making a tool. And something about machining is just, I think, a little bit more my speed than fabrication. And bike frames are complicated to make because it's not only the frame and it's the geometry, but you got to put parts on it and you got to get it painted. And, you know, you're hopefully building it for someone other than yourself. And so there's all this customer work and sales work and marketing. And something about machining tools just felt like a little bit more straightforward and accessible in my speed. And so I always liked that part of it. And I just didn't assume that I could build any sort of business around that, because the machine, like a CNC machine that could actually produce in a production volume, seemed like that would be inaccessible for me to ever just buy. And I didn't know how I would access that. But, you know, like starting about a year ago, I took a job at a CNC machine shop in town. I just kind of showed them pictures of some stuff I had machined as a hobbyist. And they said, sure, you're hired. And I worked there for a while, and I ran some other CNC machines, and I kind of saw what that looked like. And they didn't want to teach me anything or give me any opportunity to sort of play on the machines after hours. You know, so I eventually left, and I had been saving some money, and I bought this old machine that, you know, to industry, by industry standards, is slow and a dinosaur. But for someone like me, I think there's a lot of life left in it. And I've been able to, you know, use it to actually start building this business now.
You have some interesting ideas. I wanted to ask you what the most perplexing problem you've come across that you're still looking for a perfect solution. Do you have one?
I'm thinking you'd probably something related to flat mount brakes.
Uh-huh.
And I would say that the rear end of the bike is always where the most of the headaches come from.
Yep.
You know, you think of the bike, and it's like the only thing that people talk about with the rear end of the bike is like the chainstay length and the, you know, the tire clearance maybe, but that's where all the headaches come from. And then you throw disc brakes into the mix, and that really complicates things. And so I think, you know, most of the problems that I would hope to solve with clever tools would be related to the rear end, and specifically the flat mount brake. It just, for carbon builders in production in factories, it makes a lot of sense. But for the rest of us making steel bikes one at a time, or titanium or something of that, you know, regard, it's terrible because it puts the bolt right through the center of your tube, which structurally is a compromise. And then also just in terms of fabricating, it takes forever
right.
to make that joint work. And so I had an idea for a dropout that I thought about producing. I haven't finished that yet, but it would sort of solve that problem for frame builders. And, you know, if I did figure that out, I think that would be an incredibly valuable offering. But in addition to that, there's, you know, there's fixtures that you could make that would hold that part of the bike while you machined a space for a flat mount. And I think those sorts of things are right now some of the more exciting problems that I could hope to solve, because I see how frustrating that is for builders and how tedious that is for builders to deal with.
So interesting. Such a smart young man.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people do cool stuff in their 20s, like they travel or they just party or something. And I have mostly, you know, from the time that I was 20 years old, this has been like the main thing that I've wanted to do and that I've thought about doing. And so I'm like, I've just developed at least a little bit of understanding about this, but there's a lot of other stuff that I kind of maybe pushed off to later in life because of it.
You went to Philly Bike Expo this year?
I did.
Was it your first year?
Well, I've been there a handful of times, maybe four times. And I showed some bikes 2 years ago,
okay.
Actually, when I was still thinking that frames was the business model that I wanted to pursue. Yeah, no, it was a great experience. Bina throws a great show.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's a party. You know, it's a great time to go and to see all these people. As a frame builder, you're sort of, I mean, for me anyway, I've been very isolated that a lot of the people in my life, I love them, but they're not frame builders. They're not fabricators. They're machinists. And you know, you spend a day in the shop and you're just thinking about all the stuff you're doing, and then you go to your sort of domestic life or whatever, and people can't really relate. And when you go to these shows, here you are surrounded by all your peers and the people you've looked up to for years in the trade, and you're just talking bikes the whole time. It's amazing. It's wonderful. And then for me this year, you know, it was actually good for business. You know, I showed up and there were a handful of things that I sold as a result of being at the show. that actually, in a dollars and cents way, made the show viable for me. And, you know, so that's a win-win. You can't turn that down.
Right, right. So what do you do when you aren't working?
Well, what do I do?
I don't know.
Obviously, I like riding bikes. I get a lot of joy out of cooking. I like to cook at home. Just, you know, simple meals, but, you know, putting it together in a way that tastes good and is nutritionally available, that feels real good to me. I've always been something of a musician. I like playing bass a lot at home just for fun. And I like walking my dog and snuggling with my dog.
We're going to talk about your dog in a minute here because, of course, everybody knows I love animals. So I'm the rest of the interview's like, I don't care. It's going to be about the dog. Anyway, let me ask you about your idea about doing a podcast, because I saw that you're going to have a podcast soon. Who would be your first guest if you haven't? Have you already done a show?
I haven't recorded any yet. Okay. Yeah, no, I want to make a podcast, and I sent out 10 emails or so to different frame builders who I know I would like to interview and who I know well enough. I have enough rapport with them that even though there are no existing episodes of the podcast to point them to, I feel like I know them well enough that they would maybe agree to doing it, and most of them have. And so what I was thinking of as a starting place for this show was to just go to, you know, buddies of mine who are frame builders who are established enough that, you know, people would recognize their names, and just chat for, you know, 30 to 60 minutes about bikes and turn that into a podcast. So I had sent an email to Brian Hollingsworth, who does Royal H, and Drew Goldalion, who does Engine Cycles, Eric Noren, who does Peacock Groove. I was just thinking of people who I know well enough and who also, you know, have sort of a, you know, some sort of angle or position in the industry that's, you know, kind of noteworthy or remarkable or interesting. And so that's kind of where I wanted to start with that. And just, you know, the whole idea for the show is that I want to, I mean, as a nerd about frame building, I love talking about it with people. And I also want to be providing something to the kinds of folks who I'm actually selling stuff to. So, you know, if people are buying a tool from me because it helps them in the shop, I also want to be making, you know, some sort of content that is interesting and thoughtful and helpful to those folks specifically. And I think that it's a good side project that actually serves the heart of what I'm doing. And because I have this sort of business model, it gives me the excuse to spend time making a show that I would love to make regardless.
Well, there you have it, folks. There's another podcaster in the making. Right there. So I have three questions I always ask my guests who, mm-hmm. when we talk about life. What's your favorite food? You like to cook. What's your favorite food?
My favorite food, I mean, we'll say pizza. I just, you know, anything greasy. I'm a vegan, and so, you know, that's the fun of it, is trying to make something that tastes good in spite of not having some other stuff in it that you might expect. And so, you know, I've been making pizzas like that for 10 years or something. And I don't know. That's probably my favorite.
And what music do you like to listen to?
You know, when I was in high school, I was a real metalhead, but I think it's expanded quite a lot since then. Yeah, I'll say something like that. You know, I like jazz. I like the blues. I like all sorts of stuff, but certainly heavy metal is good too.
All right. Let's talk about the Clementine. Tell me about your dog.
Well, the Honorable Clementine J. Puppy Paws presiding. We give her a lot of different names, and Puppy Paws is usually a part of it. But yeah, we adopted her like a month and a half ago. She's 4 years old. She's a mountain cur, and she's got a brindle coat that is just beautiful. It's sort of a orange and black stripes, almost like a tiger. And she's just the sweetest, snuggliest dog.
And she's well-behaved?
She's pretty well behaved. There's only a couple caveats to that. She does not like when anyone leaves. Even if someone is still with her, she gets, you maybe can hear her, she gets a little whiny when someone leaves the house.
Yes, I know that sound.
Yep. And then the other thing is if we're walking somewhere and she sees a squirrel, it's got to die. And sometimes that's a little bit too much. We got to work on some leash manners. But
yeah, well, you know, she's a baby. She's only four, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
And
so
she's a sweetie.
Yeah. Obviously, we love our dogs.
Yes.
They're awesome. So how can people find out about your work? And what is the best way? Website, Instagram, all of the above?
Yeah, social media, I'm definitely most present on Instagram. And I think the website is a great resource, cobraframes.net, because it has a lot more than just the most recent posts on Instagram. It ties together. I mean, of course, it links to my Instagram, but it ties together all these older projects that would maybe be harder to find in any other specific spot. And it links to all my other social media stuff, as well as having the web store and information about the podcast to come.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for talking with me today. So we've been talking with Joe Rogenbuck. He is CobraFrames.net out in Syracuse, young man who's up and coming in our frame building part of our sport with tools and frames. And thank you so much for talking with me. I hope you have a great holiday.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right. You have a good day.
Yep.
Joe Rogenbuck joined me from his shop in Syracuse, New York. If you are interested in learning more about him, his work, and of course to see photos of the lovely Clementine, you can log on to CobraFrames.net. So I hope you enjoyed the show this week. As we approach the holidays, we are going to start wrapping up 2018 and looking forward to the new year. Next week, we'll be talking with the bike lady. While I've been called that in the past, Kate Cook is the real bike lady, and she's doing some great things for kids. We'll also have a conversation with Tracy and Peter Flukey, a tandem couple who are about to take yet another long cross-country tour. So thank you for listening, and remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can send us a tweet at OutspokenCyclist without an E, or you can leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. The Outspoken Cyclist is a listener-supported podcast, and if you are so inclined, we would be very grateful for your donation. So I hope you have a great week. Remember to stay safe. And if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.